My name is Michael Laufer. I'm chief spokesman for the Fourth East Vinegar Collective, and I'm here at Hope to recruit you because there's still a lot to do. As was mentioned, I was here 2 years ago, and I want to thank Hope for having us back. A lot has happened in the last 2 years, and I hope to show you guys all of that and also what happened before. So, I want to start just by talking about the hacker ethic, as we do. I feel that hacking is an ethical concern. It's a good, and I argue that it's the greatest good, because what it does is it takes what's available and it leverages that in order to do more than what's allowed. And it does it for the greater good in all cases. And so many industries and movements still have so much to learn from the hacker movement that we figured out decades ago, the most important of which is the free sharing of information. This got figured out in the hacker community a long time ago, that if you kept your secrets and you said, oh, no, you're too much of a newbie, I won't show you that means that newbie's going to go out and screw it up on their own. Now, the medical community has not figured this out. The chemical community has not figured this out. The biological community is starting to figure this out, which is why we have coined the term biohacking and so many people are doing it, and it's a great blessing. It's wonderful to see. Now, specifically, we work in global health. We are trying to get medicine and medical technologies to people who otherwise wouldn't have it, however we can. So, if you didn't see my talk 2 years ago, there's me on the left. That's me throwing pills of Daraprim to the audience while Martin Shkreli was under house arrest. And I called him from stage at this phone number. Now, unfortunately, this phone number doesn't work anymore because he's in the clink for realsies. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't get in touch. If you want to write, you can write to him. I did. He didn't write me back, which is a little weird, only because when I called him, despite the fact he didn't pick up the phone, a few hours later, I had a conversation with him in the lobby, and it was weird but interesting. Now, here's the fascinating thing about the whole debacle with him. He got offered up as the sacrificial lamb. He's rotting at Fort Dix. And yet, despite everything that happened, the price of Daraprim didn't change. It's been 2 years, and the price of Daraprim didn't change. Turing Pharmaceuticals, nobody talks about them anymore. Martin Shkreli's in the clink, cool, we got ours. Everybody who needs a drug for toxoplasmosis is still screwed. I suppose I should pass out more, right? Who wants one? So, these are 200 milligram pills. Usually, they are... Here, I'll just make it rain. Usually, they're 50 milligram pills, but your first dose, you take four of them. And so that's equivalent to a first four dose. So it's $750 per pill at a quadruple dose. That was a $3,000 pill I just threw out for each of you. And don't worry, it only cost me 25 cents to make. Special thanks to the collective member who helped me make them this morning before the before the talk. Okay, so the other thing that we got known for was that shortly after we were here at Hope, we had a website set up, and the whole Mylan thing came down, and EpiPens suddenly skyrocketed in price. And a lot of people got in touch, probably people in this room, and thank you, got in touch through the website and said, why aren't you doing something about the EpiPen? Why aren't you doing something about the EpiPen? We kind of wrote back and we're like, well, you know, we kind of do chemistry stuff. And they're like, but you're doing health. Come on, make it happen. And so we did. And this was the EpiPencil. This is what came out of that. And we figured out a way to utilize off-the-shelf parts and build an epinephrine auto-injector for $30, which is reloadable. And the reloading only costs about $3. Now, this got pretty popular on YouTube, but YouTube's kind of, they said we were endangering the public. So now our good friends at the Internet Archive and the Alexandria Project are hosting it. You can still find links on our website. Interestingly, also, we weren't confronted directly by the FDA, but they did issue a statement saying, don't make your own EpiPen. Go pay extra. Despite the fact that you can buy a syringe and epinephrine and give yourself an injection, and it's perfectly legal. Loading it into an auto injector that's designed to inject other things, ooh, very bad, naughty, naughty. If that irony weren't thick enough, the next thing that happened was that EpiPens started failing left and right. They recalled 80,000 of them. Every pharmacy you walked into had a big sign saying, do you have EpiPens? Do you know that they don't work? This is the interesting thing. EpiPens are single use. You can't test them. If you have a reloadable injector, you can test as many times as you want. You can make sure it works. And they dropped the ball when they said, you guys screwed up. And then on top of it, there weren't enough for everybody. As if it weren't insulting enough that they were overcharging and they failed and they weren't safe and you weren't supposed to make your own. Also, you just couldn't get them. And again, similar to Daraprim, after all this time, it's been about a year and a half, the price hasn't changed. It's still $609 for a pair of EpiPens. Now, I saw the house lights just went down, but here I'm just going to show you. This is the setup. It's the auto injector. You take the needle from one syringe, you plop it on the other syringe, you load it, and you're good to go. Is there anybody here who suffers from anaphylactic shock? One, two, three, four. And of you, are there any of you who do not have EpiPens? So, who wants this one? Oh, sorry, I can't see. And that's one of the original ones that we did in the first video. So, use it well. Now, similar to Martin Shkreli, there was a woman who was terribly demonized for jacking up the price of a life-saving medication and being insensitive and being a terrible capitalist and lying to Congress and, you know, other things that are frowned upon. It'd be cool if I could call her too, right? Like, at this number? What do you think? Should we see if she answers? All right, let's see. So, this is a fixed VoIP, so I don't know how it's gonna pan out. But let's see, 1412741. Don't everybody call at once; it'll block the line. 2395. Is this microphone on as well? Yeah, here we go. I mean, it's ringing. I mean, maybe she's not home. I'll leave a message.
Password.
Ooh, password. What do you guys think it is, huh? I'm trying 1234. Oh, it hung up on me. All right, well, if there are any VoIP hackers out there, if you can find me the password before the end of my talk, I'll call her back. I tried. All right. Okay, let's move on. this is HIV. I don't need to belabor the point of how horrific it is, but suffice it to say that every 3 minutes somebody dies of HIV. This is GSK744, which is going to be marketed under the trade name cabotegravir by GlaxoSmithKline. And with a single dose, an 800 milligram intramuscular injection, 4 times a year, it can keep your viral load below detectable, and it also acts as a pre-exposure prophylaxis, which means that you can go into a community where there's a high viral load and just give it to everybody. You don't even have to deal with the stigma of testing. This could wipe out HIV in a closed community, which of course doesn't exist, but theoretically, in a single generation. But it's not on the market yet, so you can't have it. It's up to GlaxoSmithKline, who owns the molecule, as to whether they're going to do that, and also how they're going to price it. They have not discussed how they're going to price it, but my guess is they're not going to be giving it away. This is hepatitis C, also a big deal. Only every 3 minutes does somebody die of hepatitis C. This is Sovaldi. This actually cures hepatitis C. This is a huge deal because hepatitis is a virus. With most viruses, you live with it for the rest of your life. This drains the viral reservoir and destroys it. You take one pill a day for 12 weeks, and you do not have hepatitis C anymore. The problem is, those pills are $1,000 a piece. So you have to have $84,000 of loose cash rolling around in your pocket. So if you're rich, hepatitis C isn't your problem anymore. Nobody in this room, huh? Yeah, me neither. There's an epidemic of opioid overdose in this country. It's a huge problem. Luckily, there's an extraordinarily simple solution. This is naloxone. It's marketed under the trade name Narcan. It's getting to be more available. For a long time, you could not get this outside of a police station or a hospital. And not to say anything specific about what's happening when you're overdosing on opioids, but typically, you're not going to want to go to a police station or a hospital. It's getting to the point where it is more available over the counter in certain states, but still hard to get. Even in the places where it's over the counter, you have to give your name. You have to get a on-the-spot prescription, at least in California. It may be different in New York, and a lot of places you still can't get it. There are over a dozen botched abortions that happen every minute, and many of those lead to fatality. These two drugs, well known for decades, mifepristone and misoprostol, can 95% of the time perform a safe, easy abortion with no problems within first trimester or so. But even in places where abortion is allegedly legal, like the United States, it is very difficult to get and is criminalized and leads to any number of very difficult things. It says a lot about the state of humanity when we spend so much time and energy doing so much good science, so much research, and we refuse to give these medicines to the people who need it. So, what's the gap? What's the hack? What's the workaround? How do you fix this? Well, make it yourself. But that requires chemistry. All right, that's okay. People are still scared of science. It's a stigma. It's something that's going to be around for a while, probably. But if you think about the 80s or movies from the 80s, there was a terrible stigma against computers. Everybody was like, oh, scary computers. Now everybody's got one in their pocket and another one on their lap and another one on their desk at home, and it's not a big deal. A dozen years ago, rapid prototyping was a weird word that was a niche industry, and nobody knew about it except for, you know, select few people who worked really hard with gel and UV lasers. Now 3D printing is a word. You just say it. What jumped the gap? It seems that in all these cases, it was two things: a good user interface and a little bit of automation. A little bit of automation goes a long way. Can you automate chemistry? Hell yeah, you can. So these are automated chemical reactors. They're commercially available. Theoretically, you can buy them. I mean, you can't buy them. I can't buy them. Why? Well, they're full of proprietary technology, so you can't work on them yourself. If they break, you're out of luck. They're ridiculously expensive, and they will only sell it to you if you're a lab. I mean, like, yeah, cool. I know we could all pass as a lab. But still, that means you can't just like send away for it in the mail or go down to the hardware store and buy one and go home and do chemistry. But you should be able to. Just like 3D printing, just like hacking on a computer, you should be able to do it with chemistry. It's more fundamental, arguably. And we've seen so much happen in terms of trying to bring the hacking ethic into sort of, you know, tangible things. Single board computers, laser cutters, you know, the whole works. So how do you jump? So this was the very, very first version that we built. Very hack. It was just a mason jar. We punched some holes in the top. We put a tea warmer in there and a little thermocouple to measure temperature. Hooked it up to a PID controller so it regulated the temperature. And then there was a tubing in there that sort of stirred things by circulating the fluid. It was hooked up to a fish pump. It was very, very basic. We made aspirin with it, and it worked, right? It was one of those proof of concept moments where it's like, oh, this is maybe not quite as crazy as we thought. So from there, it evolved. We got a pressure controller there. There's the PID unit and the little circuitry that ran it. Some friends from Rainforest Connection helped us start doing the automation. First thing that we did was on an Arduino Uno and some breadboarding. Those are banks of little like chip relays to kick things on and off. One for the stir, one for the heater that controlled it, and what was the other one?
Oh.
The third one was for the syringe pump to inject new reagents. So here it is running. We put some LEDs to make it pretty. Here are the syringe pumps. This was an open source project that was developed by some medical people. They found this was a really necessary thing. It was ridiculously expensive, and it's just not that complicated. You have, you know, a screw motor, and you have a syringe, and you clamp it in there, and it works. And so here's a version of it, and I'll go over ours in particular later, and we have a special one here as well, which I'd love to show off. But it progressed. This was the original version, though. This was a cassette loader from a data bank that I'd scavenged. And I mean, and you know, it worked. I mean, not well, but you know, close enough is close enough. So then more people started to join the collective, and people who were enthused about 3D printing said, "Hey, maybe we can 3D print some of this." And we shied away from it at first because we were like, well, not everybody has access to a 3D printer. Let's try and use off-the-shelf parts. But as it turned out, it solved more problems than it created. And just to show you guys, here's that core, or a similar one. And as you can see, it's three pieces. It bolts together. And you have an input for the stir motor. You have an input for the reagents to get into the inner chamber where the reaction happens. And then you have two that come in that circulate fluid. And so this is what it looks like assembled. And that's, I think that's this one. It's not as similar. And that was a huge step forward for us. It was really great. And we moved off of Arduino. We started working with the Raspberry Pi because it's cheaper, it's more flexible. That's the Raspberry Pi Zero, if you recognize it. In the lower right there, you see me holding a breadboard with the Raspberry Pi Zero in the corner there. And I'm happy to announce for the first time that we now have PCBs designed. And here's the schematic. So one thing I should just pause to say right now is that even though I'm the only person you ever see in public from the Fourth East Vinegar Collective, there are a lot of us. This isn't me, okay? I don't do most of the technical work. This is done by experts who are brilliant, and they worked so hard for so many things that you're about to see. And I just want to say thank you. Some of them are here, some of them are watching. Here's what it's going to look like. We're going to be at DEF CON, and hopefully these will be manufactured by then, and we'll be giving them away because we don't sell anything. We only give things away. Here's what the backside looks like, and the traces look about like that. This will also be freely available, so if you want to manufacture them yourself, you of course can. Now, things got dark from time to time. We didn't just get trouble from the FDA and trouble from YouTube. I was invited by Dr. Von Hippel to come to MIT and talk to his friends about things that seemed cool. And he seemed so terribly friendly until we were in private. He told me that he thought I was going to dismantle the last 40 years of his work. Because, he said, you know, 3D printing didn't start with guns. Somebody's going to do something reckless, and then nobody's going to do any chemistry ever. And I thought, really? I kind of have my doubts, and I know some people who I think would disagree with that. And he said, dismantle your entire operation, change the name, stop doing it, stop talking about drugs. And I was like, dude, I don't think you get it. I wasn't setting out to try to do chemistry. I was setting out to try and get medicine to people, and I didn't care how. Happened to be that an automated chemical reactor was one of the better ways to do that. It didn't really click. But in honor of this very unpleasant set of conversations I had with him, I'd like to introduce our new core. This is a single piece printed device. I'll show you more. And we call it the Von Hippel reactor. Isn't this thing beautiful? Look at this. It's all out of one piece, and it still has all the same structural elements. There's an inlet port here for reagents. There's the stir motor shaft here. And then there are the inlet and outlet ports for the circulating fluid. And you can see when it's together, this is how it looks. Just awesome, right? Again, I'm admiring it because it's not my work. But anyway, so here's a photograph of it. And in addition, the hardware team that's been doing stuff with 3D printing said, you know, we should scale. We should have options for both everything being off the shelf and also for everything to be 3D printed, or as much as possible. So we also have a syringe pump that you can 3D print almost the entirety of. And look at this bad boy. Isn't this gorgeous? I was demoed this morning, and it turned on via a phone app. I mean, so diesel. You gotta love engineers when they over-engineer things, and you're like, that's you. I just wanted something that worked. Okay. So, there's more. In addition, there's a file format. I'm sorry, my mic just got louder. There's a file format because you have to give instructions to the machine. So we've developed a format, and I'm sorry, keeps dropping. It's a blend of Python and YAML. And it kind of looks like this. And if you look at it, you can sort of see it's not complicated, right? We have a fairly simple set of things that we're trying to do. You stir, you control temperature, you inject reagents at particular times, you put in some safeguards to make sure that nothing is going wrong. But it's nothing terribly complicated, which is why it's ridiculous that it's tens of thousands of dollars to get one off the shelf when you could build it yourself. It's just that nobody's done it yet. Well, I guess we have. So, back to the medicine part. We have an issue with many explorations into medicine that, like, big data is going to be the magic bullet that cures everything. It's not. I mean, I love big data as much as the, you know, next guy who has a background in math, but seriously, if there's anything we've learned about cancer, it's that if you get cancer, nobody's had that cancer before because it's yours. And it's about that individualized. And so in order to tackle these types of problems, it's a tailoring problem. And interestingly enough, it seems like this is true for lots and lots of ailments, not just cancer. So there need to be new approaches, and there are. Now, why is it that people aren't managing their health already? And I'm sure there are a few, you know, hardliners in the audience who are saying, well, I do, cool. But most people you know don't, unfortunately. What's happening? Why are we just so used to the way that things happen in the medical industry? You get this feeling that something goes wrong and you go to a doctor and he fixes you, or she. It's not the case. Whatever they used, that already existed. They didn't create it. They just curated it. And not that that's a useless thing. Curation is good. But why couldn't you have done that yourself? It's because it's illegal. If you decide that you're going to go out and make some medicine or buy some medicine without a prescription, that's illegal. You can't think for yourself. You can't decide you know what's wrong with you. I don't think that's right. And the only logical explanation I can seem to find as to why this is in place is because it hooks you into a system for which you have to pay. It seems to be the explanation for a lot of things, but let's not get too down on capitalism right now. So, there are a lot of methodologies. If you're ill, and you know what's wrong, and you know what you need, and you can't get it, there are lots of ways to go about it. Now, many of these, they're not terribly sophisticated, but you have to think about doing it, and you have to actually go for it. One is, you can just buy them. I know everybody here uses the internet. The drugs are out there. You want something, you can get it. Doesn't matter. Another thing that's extraordinarily easy that's often overlooked is that chemical suppliers often stock the active pharmaceutical ingredient of whatever it is. It's not for human consumption. Fine. It's not their business. Buy it, put it in a capsule. You're done. Get a scale. Get a good one. So, you can buy the precursors, right? If there's something that's very similar and it's a simple chemical reaction to get to the next step, most of what we do, you can do that. On top of that, do the research. There is, and I know everybody in here knows this, there is so much technology that's on the shelf that you can't get for silly reasons. It's no different in the medical industry. There are tons of things. If you have something that ails you, go read about it. Use Sci-Hub. It's awesome. And you can find out that there are things on the shelf that may cure what you have. You just can't buy them. And again, there's this stigma. You don't know. You're not an expert. You didn't pay $300,000 to go to medical school. Cool. Manage your own health anyway. Experts are just human beings. Yeah, maybe they know some things. Maybe they know some things you don't. Ask them. Figure it out. They had to learn a lot of things. You are just a single person. You don't need to give health to 1,000 people. Just take care of yourself, or you know, maybe somebody else. Virtual trials. We're working with a group called Cancer Commons. If you have an incurable cancer, please go talk to Cancer Commons. They're amazing. And what they do is they do these virtual trials doing what I've just described. They know the literature so well that you give them all of your data, and they're like, oh yeah, there's something that somebody thought might work, but they couldn't get a trial together. We'll have to go figure out a way to make this drug or buy it. And they save lives every day, and they're just wonderful, wonderful people. So there's no reason that something similar couldn't happen with regular diseases or orphan diseases specifically. Now, I need to talk about the chemistry a little bit because this is the place where everybody always gets hung up. They always say, oh, but chemistry is difficult. What if you get it wrong? What if the reaction goes poorly and you manufacture something you didn't want? It turns out to be poison instead of the medicine. What if it blows up? A million different things. The big gag that we worked on so hard for the first year or so after we stopped being an underground organization was trying to build new reaction pathways that were safe. They didn't have weird side reactions, even if you screwed them up. There were huge margins of error. But doing that's difficult, finding new pathways for chemistry. How do you do it? Well, use a chemist and a computer working together. It's the most powerful tool out there, right? A machine learning system and a human to sort of manage it. This is a screenshot from the Chematica software. These guys were able to use fairly sophisticated machine learning to crawl back through 400 some odd years of chemical literature, and they'll find any reaction that's even related to what you're trying to do. And what they'll do is they'll try and find a new reaction, a plausible new reaction, based on whatever parameters you gave it. And so we gave them all these parameters, and that's how we got most of our stuff. And they were very good to us when they were a startup, but they're not a startup anymore. Merck bought them, and they don't even return my phone calls. They were very good to us in the beginning, though. They've been absorbed, and oh, right, we can't use their software anymore, even though when we were using it, it ran about $40,000 for a reaction. And Merck and I aren't friends anymore. They posted this on Twitter saying, hey, if you have cancer and are having trouble eating healthy, here are ways to economize. And I was like, that's kind of rude. And they're like, hey, call us. So, you know me, I called them. They didn't call back. I apparently have been expedited, but I didn't hear from them. Now, interesting thing to think about, and one of the things that I reiterate all the time, is that the magic thing about science is that it works. It's a human right. It's your birthright as a human being to be able to inquire, to think, to use logic, reasoning, figure out what it is. What do you want to do? And so, you know, what was Chematica doing? They were doing, you know, data science with data. How hard could it be? So here on the left, you see a diagram of the structure of the data that was given in their first paper. I have these reversed, I'm sorry. So Reaxys is their database. It's the 6 million reactions. That's the one on the left. This is what we did as a first pass. NIST is an open source database. It only has 1,000 reactions, but that's not enough. I am at a hacker conference, right? Because data sometimes falls from a truck. Now, there's a little catch here, and this is part of my recruiting process. Three different people got this data that fell from a truck and posted on the darknet. These three QR codes are the addresses for them. Please take pictures. This MD5 hash, you can hash to make sure that you downloaded it correctly. Now, is password protected? And nobody I know has managed to crack it. And a little bird told me that it's likely that the passphrase is long, like maybe more than 20 characters. So all of you who are good at, it's a tarball file. So all of you who are good at cracking passwords, please do it. All of you who are not good at cracking passwords, please download this anyway. Keep it out there. Make sure it doesn't get taken down. And whoever the hell those three people were who managed to get this and post on the darknet, wherever you are, thank you. So, I want to talk about opiate overdose again. We kind of backburnered this a while ago because we realized it was becoming more available, and it was really, really hard to do chemistry-wise. Not because the chemistry was difficult, but because the precursors for naloxone are the same as the precursors for opiates. So they're highly controlled. You get flagged like that, and you can't buy more than a tiny, tiny amount. You need licenses and all this. It was such a mess. But then we had this idea. We thought, well, if you're going to deny us the medicine because it's too similar to the poison, maybe we could just make the medicine from the poison. Opiates are easy to get. Maybe we could reverse engineer it. And fuck yeah, we did. So that's Oxy on the left, which is available on every street corner in every city in America. And it's cheap. In the 90s, it was found out by some very clever drug dealers that you can do a one-pot shot reaction with an 87% yield and get oxymorphone. Oxymorphone is something like 6 times as powerful. More bang for your buck. Thank you, drug dealers. Interesting point. Oxymorphone, you can make into naloxone in one step. Again, with a very high yield, and it's fairly easy. So, medicine from the poison. Now, I'm going to ask another question in the audience, and I can't see you guys very well, but how many people, raise your hand if you've actually seen an opiate overdose happen? Yeah, it's really scary. Of those people who just raised their hand, how many people think that it's possible that you might see one again? Who wants this one? Come on up. And I've got more, so come talk to me. Now, we love that we're doing this. And, you know, like every hacking organization, we just want to push it. We want to do more. It never feels like enough. Human rights work is like that. You just never feel like anything you do is enough. So we wanted to push it a little further. Make medicine from the poison. How about we make the poison the medicine? One of the biggest problems still in HIV transmission is intravenous drug use. Now, there's pre-exposure prophylaxis that can keep you from catching HIV, but you have to take it pretty religiously. Interesting thing, intravenous drug addicts, there's one thing that they do take religiously. They're intravenous drugs. So, we've decided to start making deals with heroin distributors to put pre-exposure prophylaxis into their cut. 100% adherence. Your heroin has a new side effect. You don't get HIV from it anymore. Here's another one. RU486, it's one of the two drugs. It's that's the abortion drug. Estradiol is a hormone replacement therapy. It's given to postmenopausal women and trans women. And we found this wonderful transition. It's fairly simple. I don't have the reaction in between, but it's a simple reaction. And so you can build it. But there's another problem. It's hard to get estradiol anymore. There's a huge shortage. And some of the estrogen compounds are not being manufactured anymore for no apparent reason. Nobody's come out saying why. And it's not super clear, except maybe, oh right, the medical industry is super homophobic. But we kind of knew that. However, there's still a workaround, because there's always a workaround. You can just buy it. Again, it's a chemical compound, and you have to convince them you're a lab, but the interesting thing is that if you take it transdermally, i.e. through an injection or using DMSO, you need a very, very small amount. So this is wicked cheap. If you pack into pills, maybe an order of magnitude more, but still affordable. There's always a workaround. There's always a workaround. Now, something that I think is not said enough is that nobody ever sets out with the goal of having an abortion. This doesn't seem clear in the discourse. I don't know why. Nobody is happy about it, ever, ever. But it's necessary in some cases. And I think it's horribly unlikely. But if somebody wants one right now, I have the drugs in my pocket. and I'll hand them to you. And furthermore, I understand that not everybody likes coming up on stage and showing the world, especially in such a touchy case. If that is the case, you can come see me after. I have them in this pocket. Let me know. Okay. So I was going to demo the reactor, but I don't have time for that. What I'm going to do is during the unconference sessions, I'll have things set up. You can come in and chat about it. There's another thing I'll do with that as well. I'm not even sure if I have time to show the user interface. I've shown it at other talks, and it's really slick. But it talks you through it. It shows you what's going on. And if I have time, I'll come back to it. But it's really pretty. Just trust me. This is the really heartbreaking part. When you look at the CDC's website, if you ever had a doubt that institutionalized racism, sexism, classism, homophobia were there, it's absolutely clear. This is a federal government agency that has every incentive to be like, no, we're really nice to everybody the same. And they will tell you, if you have darker skin, you are much more likely to catch HIV. If you present as homosexual, you are much more likely to die in a hospital. If you are poor, all manner of horrible things are going to happen. And the poor part is the really big one because it's perpetuating. Being poor makes you sick. I mean, that's a simplification, but there are these direct connections. And it feeds back because if you're sick, it makes you poor. This happened just a few weeks ago. A woman stepped out of a train and slipped between the gap between the train and the platform. The platform cut into her leg so deeply her femur was visible. Her femur was visible. And what did she scream? Not help. She screamed, please don't call an ambulance. Because she was afraid she couldn't afford it. And she was probably right. This is why we have to take control of our own health, because we don't have options anymore. This is ridiculous. And this isn't an isolated case. There are a zillion of these. You see all of these things where there are any number of basic treatments that cost way more than they should. It's ridiculous. And interestingly enough, there's no law against it. You own the rights to a drug? You jack up the price? Yeah, maybe the public doesn't like you. But nobody can stop you. It's gotten so crazy to the point where hospitals make their own drugs on site. I'm not the first person to think about this. Not even the 50th or maybe the millionth. This is happening. So I need to beat down on Mark a little more. They came up with this really great treatment for cancer. It's called Keytruda. It cured Jimmy Carter, and he was big deal about it. He was on his deathbed, and then it, healed him. Problem is, not cheap, okay? Now, first thing that I always think when I see something like that is I say, well, how'd they make it? Those are just some people. And this is a thing that we all have to remember. Anything that's ever done, it was first done by one person. There was a first instance, and they were just trying it. They're not that much different than you. So how'd they make it? This is a Chinese hamster. That's a breed. I'm not saying like hamster came from China. Chinese hamsters have ovarian cells that are very rich for genetic engineering. And these cells are used to create Keytruda. And I hang out with biohackers a lot, and I was like, yeah, I should chat with them about that. And then I got to thinking again about more orphan drugs. Here are the five most expensive drugs on the planet. They're all orphan drugs. Less than 100,000 people in the world have the thing that each one of these treats. And Notice that it says per year after each of these, okay? These aren't things you can take once and you're okay. This is something that you have to take daily, and oftentimes it's the difference between being bedridden and not being able to interact with the world and having a relatively normal life. But there's a law in the books that says, oh, if you're treating an orphan disease, not only do you get special treatment from the FDA so that your patent goes through faster, you can hold on to your patent for like four times as long. Oh, right, also, we give you more money, even if, which is usually the case, the research for your drug came from federal labs. Sorry. Now, where did these come from? Well, this one's a virus, and it comes from armyworm cells. This one is an antibody that's pulled from NS0 cells. This is an enzyme that you build with recombinant DNA. This is also an enzyme that you can get after you genetically engineer E. coli. And the last one, you can just pull it from human blood. How about that? You don't even have to engineer it that much. Now, let's not make a mistake. These are non-trivial procedures. And even setting up a mammalian cell lab is non-trivial, but expensive. But once you do it, it's set. It's a one-time cost. Engineering these further, that's nominal. So keep that in mind. This is George Church, another famous guy who, you know, used to be a biohacker. I met him about a year ago at the MIT Bio Summit, and he said the most beautiful thing. We were having a fireside chat, and somebody said, what do you see as the future of biohacking? And he goes, well, the elimination of disease, the elimination of world hunger, poverty eliminated, and then traveling to colonize the stars. And he said it kind of like that, like of course, right? What are you thinking about biohacking? And then this quote came out in the New York Times, and we all felt a little betrayed. Now, word around the campfire is that his quote was taken out of context. It probably was even misquoted. I hope to see him again and ask him at this year's MIT Bio Summit, which you should all come to, by the way. But somebody thinks this somewhere, and I think we should all give them these four words. Like I said before, pursuing science is a human right. It's the most basic human right. It's the human right from which all other human rights flow. You have to be able to do whatever you want to your body. You have to be able to think in whatever way you want. That includes pursuing science or any modus of thought. And if anybody gets in your way, you tell them. So, how do we do this with these cells that need to be engineered for these special diseases? Well, we have a way. Cells replicate with perfect fidelity most of the time. And so you can just share them. And this has been done for thousands of years. Sourdough starter, yogurt. You can go to a Greek restaurant and they say, oh, our yogurt has been known for, 100 years, and it's amazing. So it works. And we can set up a cell library so that we can share it. There are stable ways that you can mail cells. And, oh, we don't have audio. I'm sorry. Some of you recognize this. And never again pay for a service that would be cheap if it weren't run by a bunch of profiteering gluttons. So, anybody who's studied the Tor system, envelope within an envelope, we need help with the protocol. Okay, so this is important. We haven't quite figured out how to anonymize things sufficiently so that we can send things around and keep things safe, but it seems like it's going to work. Now, in addition, we have other ways. There was a guy who gave a talk a couple hopes back on using the postal system. There's a book rate. Fungi grow really well on books. You can ship them. Additionally, book rate really means media mail. And we've been experimenting with doing streaked plates on CD cases. Totally workable. All right. Now, I'm being told that my time is running short, but I have one more thing that I want to show everybody. And this is the most common infectious disease in human beings. And it is cavities. This is a 17-year-old from the Appalachian Mountains. He's 17. His teeth are rotted so badly that he had to have like 25 of them extracted. They were so terribly rotted that he wasn't responding to local anesthetic. That's how bad it is. So, how do you deal with this? What is this? Well, this is a strain of strep. It's strep mutans. This is a thing that lives in your mouth, that eats sugar, and gives off lactic acid. Lactic acid breaks down your tooth enamel, and that leads the way for greater infection. You have an immune system. Why can't we vaccinate for it? Well, we can. Difficulty is that you have to vaccinate within the first year of life because everybody gets this so quickly. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could somehow knock that out? It's just a bacteria. Can't we do something? Yeah, we can. I was hoping to pass this out too. But in the year 2000, a guy genetically engineered a strain of strep that outcompetes the other one and gives off ethanol instead of, it's just a trace amount, instead of lactic acid. You brush your teeth with this once and you never have cavities for the rest of your life. I have this bacteria currently in the mail on its way here. It might even be in the FedEx place across the street. But I will be handing this out tonight, tomorrow night, or maybe Sunday. Come find me and we'll have a party. So one last thing before I wrap up. I had this great dream that like we would be able to just share it. Like, oh, it's in my mouth? Hey, you want some? Now the biologists have all told me, that, look, it doesn't work that way. I'm like, come on, maybe there's just like a small chance? And they're like, and all of them were like, no, Michael, it doesn't work that way. And one of them was like, well, maybe one in every 3,000 it might. I was like, there's a chance. Let's all make out. So, come visit us tomorrow. There's gonna be a little more kissing. My slide's not advancing because I have this automated. So come visit us tomorrow or on Sunday in the morning. We should have it and never get another cavity. This, of course, life finds a way. And my favorite fictional mathematician, probably, the little thing left out, we're life too. And we found a way. And here we are. So, last thing. The important thing is that we have to share information. We need to share knowledge. We need to help people understand and not be afraid to try things. We need to destigmatize looking at things, because oppression comes from resource control, and resource control comes from information control. And information control is only possible when information is commodified. And the only way that that can happen is when information is shrouded. This I love. I always throw it up. And I'm here to recruit you. I want all of you to be part of what we're doing. This is an empty wall. But we'd like to see more walls look like this. My very last slide, I always put this at the end, and I always get choked up. Thank you so much. So it looks like I still kind of have 5 minutes. I can take one or two questions. The other thing that I should mention, I can't take questions. All right. So listen, I will take questions, just not on stage. I'm going to clear my stuff out so that the next people can show up. I'm hard to miss. I will be here all weekend. And right after this, I'm probably going to go out with Four Thieves members and allies, and we're going to have a little cocktail, celebrate all the good hard work that we've done. I invite all of you because you're members now too. Thank you so much.